Do you have it on a disk drive? Thumb drive?
I have it on my laptop. I do have it on my thumb drive. Do you have internet access?
Yes.
Okay.
It'd be better if we could just put it right over on
the computer. Yeah, that's fine. I can give it to you on my thumb drive. I do need a video on it.
There should be access to the internet. If not, I'll...
If you have a block, I do have a...
I'll make it happen.
Entertain a motion to approve the agenda as amended. Motion for full, second full, and question motion.
Is there access to the internet here?
Oh, yes.
Or is it stuff on the computer yet? No, this one. Plug that in for me. No. No, we're not doing the laptop. We're running off this.
Introduce our speakers today and welcome the audience members and thank you all for participating in Sussex County's Fair Housing Workshop. We have representatives here from the Delaware State Housing Authority as well as the State Division of Human Relations who are going to conduct the workshop today. This is open to the public. This is supposed to be interactive, so any questions that you may have, feel free to engage. There are refreshments in the back, and we will also have food a little later on, closer to 12. It's supposed to run until 12. We can go a little over if we have to, but these members need to be back up in town by 1 o'clock. So with that, if you want to get more comfortable and move back to the audience, you can. Or if you want to pivot around, I will introduce our guests, and we'll begin the workshop.
In fact, if you want to, I'll take this.
Good morning. I'm Tom Lawson. Okay, terrific. Do you want me to have you hand it out?
I'm sure you can hand out there.
Forward and backward, it's on the machine, and then when you're ready for the internet, just let me know.
Actually, you
want to
find it
now?
It's actually a YouTube, put in Billings,
Mon, Billings,
Billings,
Stefan. What's the key for this? We got 5 minutes for that. No, I know, it's good. Billings, Montana.
Billings, MT, discrimination video.
Okay, on YouTube?
Yes.
You're not here.
What is going on with the bees? Fair housing discrimination?
Yep, that one. You can open that up. It's half on the side from it.
Yeah, to cut those lights out, so... Yeah.
Stefan?
Yes.
Is there audio with this?
Yes.
Okay. All right. It's on the taskbar when you're ready.
Okay.
I need this down.
Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
I'm Vince Fedroff. I'm the Supervisor of Division of Human Relations, and on behalf of Ramona Fulman, she is our director. She unfortunately could not be here today for a personal reason. There's a death. But I'm here instead. So along with Ms. Inez Hungria, she's going to be your presenter this morning. She is a veteran of several years of experience within division, a very prolific, very seasoned investigator who is very, very knowledgeable. She's going to provide you a lot of information and awareness about fair housing, education. One of the reasons we're here today is to we're expanding throughout the entire state to try to educate everyone, folks within the industry, elected officials, lenders, landlords, and so on and so forth, about what it is about fair housing, in an effort to be very, very proactive and provide you a very fundamental understanding of what is about fair housing and how it applies to you. And actually, it really touches across all facets of life, many, many different people, from people who are occupants to homes to people who own homes and rent and so on and so forth. So I think you're going to find this information very, very valuable. The information we're going to provide this morning, as you see there as a public official, officials, is to, at your level of understanding, what you need to know as elected officials. If you, if I can use the terminology at the 50,000-foot level, okay, that's kind of where we're going to be. We don't want to get down into the weeds too much and confuse you with a lot of little details, but we want to give you an overview where you need to know as far as your knowledge and understanding what is how it applies to you, okay, which is very, very important. One of the things that we try to do is let people know, you know, why is fair housing important to me? Okay, a lot of people might be asking yourself this morning, and that's okay. You know, why are we doing this? You know, why are we here? Fair question. Myself, before I got into the business, I had very little to no experience as far as fair housing law, HUD law. And consequently, I realized how much I didn't know. Okay, so we're going to try to provide you a very good fundamental understanding of fair housing law, as well as how it applies to you, because really it impacts everybody. And it's very, very important that you understand what it is we're going to be talking about, because it affects everybody here. Okay. Make sure I can run this properly. There we go. Okay. If you would, before we get into the agenda, hopefully everybody has a packet of information. And kind of turn your attention to that real quick. I'll just let you know what we have in there provided for you, so we're not having to cover that. We've given you a lot of valuable information from our Title VI, Chapter 45. This is what gives us our guidance in fair housing, okay? And if you ever want to information on it, you want to go out to the website and kind of peruse, I would encourage you to do that. There's some very, very valuable information in there. We also have 7 keys to affirmatively furthering fair housing. Okay, it's a mouthful. What is affirmatively furthering fair housing? Well, we're going to talk about that. That's really a very key element to for our training today. We also have a glossary of terms, and we also have one of our handouts. Get a copy of the agenda. We also have this, which is very, very nice, product that, again, Ms. Hungria put together. Has all our commissioners on it. If you ever want to know who your commissioners are, some very basic information about our objective and our mission, what it is we do, what the Human Relations Commission does, really important. And on the back, it also has contact information. So, again, I would encourage you to keep this handy in case you ever need to contact somebody at the commission or ourselves. And then last but certainly not least, we have an evaluation critique, if you will. You know, let us know how we can improve the presentation, if there is a way. And please be honest on that. You know, we're okay. You know, if we do something to improve it. All right. With that, kind of give you an overview. Going to go into our objectives. What is the purpose of the training? Our mission and the authority vested in the State Human Relations Commission. Some of you may. Is anybody here on any type of commission for the state? Nobody? Okay. There's a number of commissions that are appointed by the governor out there. The State Human Relations Commission is just one of many. And we'll kind of give you an overview of what it is exactly they do. They perform an outstanding job, 28 volunteers appointed by the governor. And what it is, our mission, you know, how we work for them in tandem in providing an overview, kind of keeping our finger on the pulse, if you will, of human relations in the state of Delaware. It's really a lot of responsibility, but it's something we take very seriously and we enjoy. We also have a video we're going to show you. Videos are always nice. They kind of give you some illustrations as far as what it is we're talking about. Go into a little training and, you know, some scenarios, if you will, some questions and answers. I know some of you may have some questions up front, and that's okay. If you do have a burning question, you just can't wait, you know, please let us know. You know, please ask the question, because somebody else might be having the same question too as well. And we'll do our best to try to entertain those. If not, at the end, if you think about a question, you know, please let us know too as well. If for some reason after the training, you know, you thought about a question and you really need an answer, give us a call. You know, you can email us, give us a phone call, you know, what have you, and we'll do our best to answer the question. Okay. And, of course, we have our valuations. Okay. We talk about fair housing law, federal and state. You might say, why do we need to know what the federal law is? Well, that's kind of where the state has pulled their information from. That kind of gives us the foundation of fair housing law going back many, many years. The protected class is very important. A lot of people simply don't know what those 11 classes are. Okay, we're going to let you know, really key you in on as far as the what they are and really to try to describe, define for you. A lot of times people simply don't know. prohibited activities. Some of the exemptions in the law, too, as well. Reasonable accommodations and modifications. Just up the top, up front, does anybody have an idea of what accommodations or modifications are as far as fair housing? Anybody have an idea? Nobody? Okay, well, that's good. That way we know it's something you're going to, you know, take with you, something as far as disability. Disability awareness is very, very important right now, as you're well aware of, because of within the persons with disability community. Okay, it's very important. Any landlords here? Okay, one. All right. Very important to know information like this as far as, you know, when somebody requests an accommodation or a modification. And the affirmatively furthering fair housing. I always have a hard time with that. You know, what is that mystical thing? We're going to cover that, which is really important, because where we get that from, that is directive at the high level, at the national level. Okay, so really important to know what that is. The complaint process, very simply, if somebody comes to you, maybe as an elected official, and say, you know, I have a problem. I think I have a discrimination. You know, what do you think is going to happen? Where should I go? And you can kind of give them a very basic fundamental understanding of what's going to happen. At very least, you can point them in the right direction. Well, call these folks here. Here's their 800-877 number. Okay, and of course, then also remedies too as well. We're going to give you a basic understanding of the fair housing laws. Again, awareness of the protected classes, awareness of the prohibited activities, and of course, some knowledge and just some understanding. And I'd like to throw in there probably another one beyond the basic knowledge level, being aware, but rather an appreciation, if you will. Okay, that's something that, you know, we can't test for. You know, if we ask you a question, well, how many can identify the protected classes? Well, that's a knowledge question. Okay, as far as an appreciation of, you know, what it is we're talking about, that's something at a whole different level. You know, one level is, okay, I get it. You know, I understand what you're saying, but I don't believe it. And that's okay. Sometimes people don't. You know, but we want to give you a fundamental, maybe an appreciation from what you did have before the training started. Okay. We're going to talk about the Fair Housing Act and equal accommodations, and also mediation. We're also trained mediators as well. We deal with educational issues, police conflicts, when you have problems within the community, neighborhood tensions. Again, a lot of times related to probably a perfect example I can think. How many remember the issue, actually still ongoing, with the Zimmerman case going on down in Florida? Okay. How many would agree that there's neighborhood tension created by that? Yes. Yeah. Okay. If we were down there, we would try to have our fingers in, you know, and see what's going on, because obviously there's tension there. Okay, so that's what we do there. And hate crimes. Another thing we don't always like to talk about, but... Okay. And then mission statement for the State Human Relations Commission is very simple, very straightforward. Okay? I'll let you read that. Again, at the very high level view, that's what they do. They really have their fingers on the pulse of what's happening in the state as far as how well people are getting along and being treated. Okay? Which side do you pick up?
We're going to play a video here.
Okay. All right. With that, we're going to go ahead and show you a short video here.
Hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all people are created.
All people are created.
Like all people are created.
And created equal.
Yeah, what can I do for you?
We're just in this apartment.
Yeah, let me show it to you.
Have any air conditioning in this place?
Nope, no air conditioning, and our lot's full, so you'd have to park on the street. Here, fill this out. I need 5 references.
How much is the deposit?
$900.
What kind of Indians are you, anyway?
What difference does that make?
Well, there's no parties here. I'll tell you right now, the people would rat you out in a heartbeat.
That all people are created equal.
Well, hi there. What can I do for you?
Hi, we're interested in the apartment.
Well, sure. Let's take a look at her.
Does this get pretty hot in the summer?
Well, it's not bad. We've got some of those window air conditioners.
Do you need any references? Because we just moved up here from Nebraska.
Oh, just the last place you live. Now, the deposit is $350, and you'll have 2 designated parking places in our parking lot out back. Now, if you need anything, you just come to me.
Being created equal is one thing. Being treated equally is an entirely different matter, and that's what the Fair Housing Act is all about. Because what you've just seen is illegal, and it happens right here in Billings.
I'm really sorry, but you've got so many kids, and this is such a busy street.
Sounds reasonable. Maybe she just didn't know. But what she should have pointed out is that anything can be dangerous. The street, a balcony railing, or a swimming pool. Because under the law, the tenant accepts the responsibility. You can't be denied housing because you have too many kids.
This is Mike. He's a veteran with a mental disability. His disability is controlled by medication. He owns a modest home and has about $50,000 in the bank. His mother and father manage his money. Mike wants to build a nicer home on a 1-acre tract closer to his parents.
I'm afraid I won't be able to approve your loan. I just don't think you'll be able to handle it.
But we've been banking with this bank for years.
We'd be glad to co-sign. I'm sorry.
In this community, one of the least understood concepts is that of disability. Very simply, the law states reasonable accommodations will be made for people with disabilities. In this case, even though Mike had a sizable bank account and qualified co-signers, his loan was turned down. But a good thing happened in this case. A complaint was filed on Mike's behalf. There was a settlement. Mike and his parents went to another bank, and a loan was secured. Today, because the Federal Fair Housing Act is in place, Mike is living comfortably in his new home, and the staff at his former bank has been trained to provide what we call reasonable accommodations for people with disabilities. Reasonable accommodations include allowing a necessary wheelchair ramp or the widening of doorways, or a service animal where pets are not allowed. In this case, the bank did not reasonably accommodate Mike's disability because he was financially sound and had qualified co-signers.
When Carol, a single mom, and her son moved here from the Midwest, they found temporary housing downtown. Soon things started looking up, and they were ready to move.
Hi, I'd like to see the apartment you want to advertise.
Is this your son?
Yes, he is.
We don't allow children.
Sorry, Mom.
That's okay.
Unfortunately, they ran into an obstacle. Not only did the manager illegally deny Carol and her son housing, he placed the blame directly on a 10-year-old. It does happen in Billings. It happens more often than you may think.
Sometimes it's an honest mistake, but sometimes it is a calculated and deliberate act. That's why we have the Federal Fair Housing Act, to make sure that all Billings residents have the opportunity to secure fair housing. The law is clear, and we want you to be familiar with it. Most landlords, realtors, financial institutions, and insurance companies comply with the law.
Okay. Before we turn a training portion over to Ms. Hungry, I just wanted to cover one other bit of handout that we did give you. It was the analysis of impediments to fair housing choice. This is not the entire report. The entire report's about this thick, but okay. These are really the salient points. I really encourage you to go through these. This was done by a contractor that was done very extensive research in the state as far as some of the barriers to fair housing that apply to fair housing law. Okay, so very good information in here. I would encourage you to to review through it. That's one of the reasons why we're giving the training. Is in most cases, a lot of the cases, there was training was one of the solutions to that. And one final thing I would say on these videos, every time I see that, you might be looking at that saying, those were just scenarios they were making up. Those were actors, yes, but every one of those scenarios, believe it or not, have actually occurred in this state, those type of scenarios. So, yeah, it still happens, unfortunately. So, with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Ms. Hungria. Again, if you have any questions, please feel free, or if not, at the end of the presentation.
Okay. All right. We're going to start going over. These are the two laws, Title VIII and Title VI, that give us the division our teeth in order to investigate fair housing complaints. And we're actually going to go over some of those protected classes. We're actually going to be going over some case examples, so this is just not me talking to you. I'm going to need some feedback from you on what your thoughts are in some of these case examples that we're going to go over. So just to go over the protected classes, race, color, national origin, which is a native country from the individual or their ancestors, religion, which is a belief and or worship of a controlling power. Familial status is a parent or designee with the presence of children under the age of 18, a person who is pregnant, or someone who is in the process of securing legal custody of a minor. Disability, a person with a mental or physical impairment that substantially limits a major life activity, a record of having such an impairment, or being regarded as having such an impairment. Sex, which is male or female, and it also covers sexual harassment or a hostile environment. Now, those protected classes that we just went over are covered by the state and the federal government. These are the four protected classes that are not covered by the federal government and are only covered by the state of Delaware, which are marital status, sexual orientation, which was recently added, creed, and age, 18 years of age or older. Now, there are three types of discrimination. Overt, which is a blatant treatment, is pretty much on its face. It's obvious that it was discrimination. Differential treatment, pretty much treating someone differently based on their protected class. And disparate impact. Disparate impact is pretty much a lot of statistics that go into preparing that case, pretty much as a practice or policy, which is uniformly applied. On its face, it doesn't look like it's discriminatory, but as you, pretty much apply some statistics, we can pretty much make an argument that it affects a person of a protected class. Case one, your turn already. A zoning officer reversed an initial decision that a group home for recovering substance abuser was a permitted use under the zoning ordinance following expression of neighborhood and city council opposition. Does anybody agree or disagree? He pretty much changed his decision based on the neighborhood and city council opposition of this type of home. Anybody have any comment about it? No? All right, let's move forward. Case number two. A zoning ordinance requiring a six-person group home for persons with disabilities to secure a certificate of occupancy when a six-person home did not house people with disabilities did not have to secure such a certificate. Can anybody tell me what the protected class in this case would be?
The disability,
yes. So here are some of the prohibited acts. In the sale and rental is the refusal to sell, rent, or deny inspection of a property, refusing to negotiate for the sale or rental of a property, to just make housing unavailable or deny the housing, to induce or attempt to induce entry or intimidate, interfere, or coerce someone in the sale or rental of a property. You can also discriminate against a person in the terms and conditions and privileges of a sale or rental. And then when you talk about provisions of services or facilities, sometimes a homeowners association provides a service, so that's where that would tie in. Whatever services they provide, they could also possibly be discriminatory. Here's some additional what's prohibited. Discrimination in mortgage lending, pretty much making a mortgage, offering different terms and conditions and points, interest, and fees. The appraisal of a property could possibly be discriminatory. Refusal to purchase a loan, and then some purchasing a loan pretty much on the market could possibly be discriminatory if once investigated. Here are some additional prohibited acts: to make, publish, or print, which indicates a preference or a limitation. Sometimes you'll see ads that indicate, you know, we have actually some example ads that say we don't allow children. And actually sometimes it's not written or published somewhere, but some people say it in the application process. Even the statement alone could be discriminatory. To threaten, coerce, or intimidate and interfere anyone from exercising their rights or assist someone else in exercising their rights. And then, of course, the refusal or delay of a reasonable accommodation modification. So we're just going to touch a little bit on what qualifies a person with a reasonable accommodation. What qualifies a person with a disability? I'm just going to cover up some few things. In addition to the Fair Housing Act and the Delaware Fair Housing Act, the Section 504 also covers recipients of federal monies when it comes to providing reasonable accommodations for persons with disabilities. Here, what qualifies a person? The person has to have a mental or physical impairment which substantially limits one or more major life activity. He has to be regarded and have a record of such disimpairment. Now, these are but limited. They're not limited to some of the mental impairments that could affect a person with a disability. Now, just so that you know, when it's regarding drug addiction, it's not current use of a controlled substance. They actually have to be rehabilitated and show proof that they went through rehab in order to be covered under the Fair Housing Act. Any questions about impairments? These are some of the substantial limitations: caring for oneself, walking, hearing, breathing, learning, working. These are just a few examples of them. So these are the areas that are not protected: current illegal use of a controlled substance, sexual behavior disorders, gambling, and if it's a direct threat to the health and safety of others. So if approving something is a direct health and safety, then that can be your defense. Who's subjected to the Fair Housing Act? Property owners, private landlords, banking institutions, insurance companies, pretty much everybody. There are a few exemptions, but These are just some examples of who's covered by the Act. These are those who are not subjected to the Act. Single-family homeowners who own less than 3 units. Religious organizations who provide a service just to their to provide services to those of their own religion. The moment they step outside and start providing that service to the general public, then the Fair Housing Act applies to them. Same thing for private clubs. Now, with the Mrs. Murphy exemption, in a home, there cannot be more than 4 independent families living there before the law applies to them. Now, in the Mrs. Murphy exemption, he or she can lose their exemption if they make a discriminatory statement. So if they make a statement that's discriminatory, they will even lose that any of these exemptions. Religious organizations, private clubs, single-family homeowners, they'll lose it if they make a discriminatory statement.
If you own 3 houses, you're not...
If you own less than 3. So for instance...
Why didn't they just say 2?
Everybody owns 2 houses.
Well, that makes... Because you can't have 2.5.
Right. But
anyway,
even,
so 3 is...
Three. So like for instance, if I own a home...
Well, I know how to count.
Yeah, no, I'm saying like for instance, the only time that this would not apply is if you make a discriminatory statement in the sale or advertisement. So if I say, well, I don't want...
Children.
I don't want males in here. I don't want certain things. No, smoking is not protected. So if you want someone who's a non-smoker, you're okay.
So you could. I sold a few.
You're okay. Non-smoker is okay, as long as it's not a protected class. You know, I don't want bisexuals here. I don't want a person of a certain creed here. You know, if you're married to somebody that I don't like and it's a protected class, just be careful. You don't even have to make that statement. If you went through your application process and you just decided not to rent to somebody because someone applied prior to them, that's okay. But the moment you make the statement, then it applies. Question?
Pets for pet owners.
For pet owners? Oh, if you don't like pets?
What about pet owners?
You don't want pets in your unit, you're okay. Now, the only thing that changes there is a person with a disability and they ask for a service animal because it combats a depression and it's a pit bull. You know, one would say that the deed restriction says that you can't have pit bulls in this area. Well, the Federal Fair Housing Act trumps that deed restriction.
Does any of this apply to manufactured home parks?
Yes. Manufactured home parks are not different. It's housing.
Okay.
Because when you look at it as housing. It houses people.
Do they have to provide medical proof that pit bull combats depression?
Yes. Now, in that case, because if you look at depression, you can't see depression. You don't know I'm depressed.
Are you?
Not right now.
Which is enough to make
you right now. I'll check with you
in an hour. Check with me in an hour. No, not right now. So you can't see it. A lot of times that requires third-party verification. So pretty much, and let's talk about third-party. Who would be that third-party? Who? Tell me, who would be the third-party?
Doctor.
Could it be anybody else?
Other family members that know you?
Yes. Anyone who knows me and knows of my disability can be the third party to verify that I need Pitbull Zeke to be my companion animal.
So I can't prevent someone from renting with a pit bull as long as their spouse says they need the pit bull to combat the pressure.
Correct. Now, 99% of the time, they'll go to a physician because they want you to know that it's a legitimate reason. A lot of times they do not know. They can just get their sister or brother or someone to give them this authorization. They'll ask you to say, look, here's my doctor's number. You want to get verification from my doctor or have it on a script and provide it that way. It's very rare that we see people say, oh, I got a third-party verification from my cousin.
So during the meanwhile, you've got all these arguments from the other people that's in your park or whatever, arguing that you're discriminating because you won't allow them to bring their dog in.
Nope. You don't have to. That,
so then you got to go back and put up signs and explain why you're doing all this nonsense.
You don't.
Right?
You don't have to explain. You don't have. If someone comes into a park and there's only one person who's there with a pit bull, and they say, "Wait a minute, I thought you didn't allow pit bulls." That's a extenuating circumstance. If you want to, I'm saying you can't. We don't allow them. We don't allow pets. That person's allowed to have it, and that can be the end of the conversation. Whether they're complaining or they're coming to you now, if pit bull Zeke is a direct threat, now you've had issues with pit bull Zeke because he done went out and bit Sarah Joe's daughter on an occasion, and he done went and bit Mr. Smith on the next block. Now he's a threat.
Does he have to bite?
He would have to cause some direct threat and harm. I'm saying just because Zeke is on the leash outside and Sarah, who's across the way, is scared of pit bulls, he didn't do anything to her.
What about if the dog is showing signs, and he's very aggressive in nature, and he hasn't bitten anyone, but you perceive the dog's behavior to be a direct threat, is that enough grounds for you to deny?
No. Just a perception, no.
I bet if Sarah goes to her doctor and her doctor certifies that that dog is causing her to be depressed.
Well, her reasonable accommodation is to move. Or I'm saying, I don't know what her reasonable accommodation would be if she got a doctor's note. But you couldn't inflict any penalties on the owner of the dog because he needs it.
So where's the copyright? Where's the owner of this park have any rights here in this situation? Why don't you just give this park to the government and say, "Government, you run it, buy it from me, I'm done, I'm out."
He could, I don't know how he would deal with that.
And that was going to be my question, because you said that, you know, when the rest of the park owners come to the, or the tenants come to the park owner and say, "We don't like that this person has a dog, and, you know, and we can't." And you said that, well, you just tell them that, you know, we can't discriminate because that dog's there for depression. And you said,
well,
end of story.
Right. That's,
but that's not the end of the story, because right. You're going to have 150 tenants as the park owner screaming at me, say, as the park owner. And I get that the law supports
correct.
The park owner's decision.
Correct.
What's your office do to come mediate that situation? Because I get that you would mediate a dispute between somebody who's been discriminated against, but
correct.
Is there any mediation or support to
come in
and say,
oh, yes.
You need to explain to my tenants why
person... Our services don't cost money to anyone. If you, as an owner, say, we have tension...
Taxpayer.
Well, yeah, I think that I went to the state, but...
it's a free lunch, yeah.
As far as that issue, you would just call us and say, look, we have some tension around here. They don't understand the Fair Housing Act. They believe that I'm just doing this to treat this person in favor, or me and him are buddy-buddy or something, they're perceiving it that way. So is there any way you can come out here and conduct training? I've went to even some senior facilities who don't even want a dog in the facility, because they feel that they should, you know, be there and not have a dog, you know, coming in the elevator with them. But we go out there, we conduct training, we answer all their questions, we provide them documentation that shows what the federal law is. And there is still some tension, and Vince can attest. We actually had to go out there twice, and then talk to the manager, talk to the residents again, and try to allow them to gain some understanding on why this gentleman, one person in the building, was allowed to have a support animal with him at all times.
And yes, if I can jump in there too, maybe try to help clarify. And one of the things that was mentioned, I think you mentioned the pet. And that's a very common thing. You know, people say, well, why can they have a pet and I can't have a pet? Not to get into semantics, but the HUD refers them as animals, as under the heading of service animals. What is a service animal? They provide some sort of service. What? Okay. Probably the most common example is a seeing eye dog. Okay. They have been specially trained for that owner to provide a service for them, because they are visually impaired. Okay. Pretty much self-explanatory there. It's not they need it to help them get along. A companion animal, okay, which is probably a little bit more vague, is under that area, let's say, probably depression. Okay, anxiety, depression, some sort of maybe a mental illness, mental impairment. that's if people have found out that helps. It's a if you will, a pill for them. Okay, it's not just a pet, but they're providing that service. So that's kind of the difference. If anybody has any, you know, for example, if I can use that as a similar example, in a nursing facility, does anybody know anybody in there? They allow pets to come in there? Yes. Okay. There's a reason for that. You know, what is the reason for allowing an animal to come in there? What do they do? You know?
Improves quality of life.
Improves quality of life, you know? It helps, gives people something to feel good about. They see an animal, you know, makes them feel good. You know, it does something for them for their therapy. There's a reason for it, okay? And I think if you have other, you would have other residents to say, well, why, you know, they are, well, the simple answer is, it's the federal law. The more detailed answer may be to help people understand is the education. Well, here's why, you know, without telling them what their diagnosis is, but here's the reason for it. And I think when people understand that, you know, a lot, it has a lot to do with communication.
So if you, on that reasoning and that way of thinking, then everybody could run to the doctor and everybody in the whole place could have a dog.
You're right.
It's on a case-by-case basis.
So if you own this home and you're renting this home out, then you get ready to rent the home again, you got a doghouse smelling place.
Right.
Now, in that case...
And that all goes back, where did your owner have any rights at all?
No, he does have rights. Let's talk about the damages. So, for instance, you cannot charge an additional fee. You can't charge, now you want a companion animal, we're going to charge you $250. You cannot do that, but if that person leaves and causes additional damages to your unit that you would have to fix, which you would normally not fix, if they didn't have the dog, then you can deduct that from whatever security deposit. For instance, like a smoker. You know, if someone smokes and they smoked and they lived in your unit for 10 years, you might have to add about 2-3 coats of paint to get that wall white. You can charge that extra amount of money.
You can never get that much money up front on some of the damage that dogs have done. I can tell you from experience, I have seen as much as $5,000 to $10,000 spent on a home. Almost one time you had to take part of the floor up, bleach it, paint the walls, everything. And there's no way you can recoup this money. So if the government's going to force a dog on you, maybe they ought to come back to the government and say, well, we're going to pay for the difference. We'll pay for fixing up your house. Or stand liable for it if they're going to force these kind of laws on us.
I got a pit bull, right, that's depressed.
Yes.
He placed me in the rear end. I'm over in BB Hospital. Now I'm depressed because... Now that dog has got more rights than I got, or
so are you the the owner? Or are you the one, the victim?
I'm the one who got. I'm the victim.
Oh, well then no, the dog. I'm saying the dog.
You said that she can have this dog. That person can have that dog because of depression.
As long as it's not a direct threat to the health and safety of others.
Well, it's too late after he bites me in the rear.
You're right, and at that point she can be either evicted or she would have to get rid of the dog.
Oh, there is a recourse.
Oh yeah, yes, okay. Yes. Once the direct threat comes into place, you can take whatever action necessary to have her or the animal moved out of the unit.
If he dies from rabies, he don't even get to sue the people.
Your question?
Yeah, question. There's actually a comment and a question. The comment is, I know that you would like to give us the 50,000-foot overview, but the problem is the snakes are in the weeds, and that's what you've just heard here for the last 15 minutes. Now, that being said, can you collect an additional deposit for a pet?
No. It's not a pet. I'm saying the best
or
way to look at it.
Or an animal or a service animal?
No.
A snake could even be the
no.
pet.
Yes, he could. An iguana. I love the thing in colors, and he supports me in a way that...
I got a suggestion. We're not going to like hearing what you're saying, and because it's all unenforceable. I mean, it's crazy. Or your group could always go after the little guy all you want because it's hard for them to defend anything against these. So why don't you just tell us all these things and maybe we can keep our mouth shut, because otherwise it just makes us all madder and madder that we're living under these kind of terms. Because creed, what the heck is creed? Nobody knows. Even if people adopt the order.
Do you know what Wiccas are?
Yeah,
people who do seances with candles?
No, I didn't know that.
And they're protected.
They're under creed.
That's right. Yes. I'm glad, thank God they're protecting
us. Yes.
like I said,
let's go.
It just makes you madder hearing what you've got to say. So maybe you better just say it.
Just keep going.
I need to know one thing.
Sure.
So you can put no pets in your ad, in your rental ad, can you not?
Yes. No pets. Yes. I don't want pets. So if it's just a pet that I decide that I like pit bulls and I want one, and it serves no purpose to me, you can deny me housing. Yeah, you can say, no, I don't want pets in my unit.
Which may discourage someone that has a pet for the purpose that you're explaining.
Well, they would bring that up. It could discourage them. Now, if they bring it up at the application process or trying to get into the unit, then you can say, now I'm not going to rent to you because you have a companion animal, and I really don't want pets in there. So then you would have us possibly coming your way.
So you can charge extra for the pet, and you can take a pet deposit.
But you can use a security deposit to pay. So, like, for instance, if they leave and there's no wear and tear in the unit, then you would just give them a security deposit back. If they leave and you saw that little Zeke tore up the carpet, you can take their whole security deposit back if that's what it takes for you to restore the unit back to what's, you know, for you to be able to rent it again. All right, so let's just go a little bit for housing for older persons. In order to deny persons who fit in the familial status category for 62 and over housing, it has to be intended and solely used for persons of that age. For instance, anyone under the age of 62 would not be able to live in that type of housing, other than if it's a senior who is taking custody of a minor. So in a case where we have a building, all 62 and over, and a young kid comes into play, a person would complain, why do you have this young kid here? Well, I've gained custody of him. Now, the property owner does not have to re-rent to that person once the lease is up. But you cannot evict them mid-lease because they've taken custody over this child. And that's the only situation that would apply. Now, for 55 and older, there's an 80-20 rule. A lot of people say, I've moved into this 55 and over community and there's young people here. Why are they here? Because it's an 80-20 rule. 80% of the housing has to have one person, 55 and over, living in the unit. That's it. So the 55 and over person can have a young husband and two kids living in the home, as long as they remain there. And it has to be 80% of the units. The other 20 can be rented to whomever.
An older guy could have a younger woman, too.
You're right. You're right. He sure can. He can be 55.
Yeah. I'm only sure that's not.
But if he's 62 and living in a 62 and over facility, he can't bring his young wife.
Remember that, Robin.
In addition to that,
we are breaking so many rules today. So many rules.
Besides having a sign that says you're 55 and over and 62, you have to show, in order to say you're denying someone with children in a 62 and over facility, you have to show that your policies, your facility, your publications, everything, all your rules apply to that type of community. So if you just have a sign outside and everything else doesn't fit this criteria, then you could possibly get a fair housing complaint against you for denying persons with children. Or someone who is pregnant in the process. So these are just some of the elements that are needed for a person who makes a reasonable accommodation request. They have to be, one, a person with a disability. Two, you must have known or should have known of the disability. Then, of course, it needs to be requested, whether verbally or in writing. If I tell you in the midst of conversation that I'm a person with a disability, now you know. Has to be necessary, reasonable, and then it's approved or refused.
Can you ask that question on the application? Can you ask if they have a disability?
Right,
no. What you can do is say you had, like, for instance, if you have a unit that's accessible, you can say we offer accessible units. You cannot dictate the needs of that person and saying, you know, when they come in to apply, oh, well, we had these great handrails. I think you would be able to use them.
So you can't ask, but you should have known.
If I give you a Social Security disability income because you're asking for my income, now you know I have a disability. You don't know what it is.
Right.
But you know I have something because this is the type of income I'm getting.
Thanks.
One more question. I've had people ask me, do you take Section 8? Now, there's no reason to say no, is there?
It's up to you.
I mean, that's not illegal.
No.
That's interesting.
No. Okay.
You can say no to
that. You can say no, I don't take Section 8.
And all these, the rules only apply to year-round rentals?
No.
A seasonal rental to beat somebody comes down for a week? They've got these rights?
Yes.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Show me that writing.
Okay. Let me give you some proof.
Show me that
writing. Give you some proof. You can't come stay here because I don't want certain people living here or staying here. Yeah, you have to. I can get you some information. One of these pictures here is for designated parking. A lot of people make this request. They live in a housing complex. They want the parking designated for them solely. They're allowed to ask for it as long as it's either a parent or they bring some documentation stating they need the parking space. Someone with a defibrillator who has a difficulty walking to the front door asks for a parking space. And this is actually one of the cases that we get all the time where people don't want to install it or want the resident to pay for it, which they're not, you know, the actual landlord or homeowner would pay to install this. These are the only two defenses you have for denial of reasonable accommodation requests. Has to be an undue financial or administrative burden to you or a fundamental alteration of how you do business. Any questions?
So fundamental alteration, that's not to the premises. That's like, that's more...
Services, how you provide. A quick example, I have an anxiety and I don't want to leave my unit, but I want you to send someone to empty my trash every day. That's not how you do business. You don't have enough people to come and empty someone's trash. So in that case, you would engage in an interactive process with that person to see what else you could do to help them with that situation. Maybe put a trash can outside in the hallway that a maintenance man would be able to empty maybe once a week, not every day.
But you're saying you would have to make those?
You would engage in an interactive process with them.
That's required?
Yes.
So if they wanted to pay extra to have someone to carry their trash from their apartment to the reception point?
They could. But if they started asking you, then you would just engage and say, we're unable to do that because we don't have the manpower. But we can think of some other things that may be able to help you.
We're getting to financial matters. Can you demand a good credit report and how would you determine what's good?
When you talk about the undue financial and administrative burden, when you make that as a defense, that's saying that it costs you too much money and administratively it's too much for you to make that accommodation. So for instance, you have a property, they make a request for reasonable accommodation, you say it's an undue financial burden. When if we come into play or HUD comes into play, they say, well, let's look at your financial capability. And it's not just, let's say it happened in this building, but you own 20. HUD says, well, let's look at all the money you get, not just the money that you get from the one sole source.
I'm thinking about when you're interviewing an applicant,
okay.
Do they have to have good credit in order to rent?
Oh, whatever your criteria is, that's fine.
So you can ask for a good credit report.
If that's your criteria for applying, then that's your criteria. This is a defense. This is a defense for denying the accommodation.
When you talk about fair, is it really fair when you said you got 19 others and this one here is going to have the extra cost? Then you're going to go back and check the other 19, see if they're making enough profit. Is that fair to make these other 19 to pay more so this one here can be accommodated? Is that fair to the other 19? When you talk about being fair, is that really fair?
Well, she doesn't write the law.
I just enforce it.
I know, but I'm just talking everything. Take it back to your people and ask them questions. Is that fair?
I sure will. Vince, is it fair?
I got this. Just here, but going back on the dog issues and the service animal, it is really amazing. Beginning March the 15th, 2011, only dogs are recognized as service animals. But under certain circumstances, miniature horses are allowed.
Correct.
Miniature horse,
pot-bellied pigs. Actually, a miniature horse is actually like a little dog. It's not just solely intended for dogs.
Let's take a more probable example. which would be someone wants to rent a unit and they need wheelchair access, and wheelchair access does not exist in that unit.
Okay.
And they want you to build a ramp and tear the door out and put a wider door in.
Okay.
What's up with that?
That is considered a modification. Right. So unless there's two different things. You have a modification, and then you have a reasonable accommodation.
Okay.
A reasonable accommodation is against your policies and procedures.
Right.
The modifications are structural changes. So in that case, the tenant would be required to make those to make those changes. They would just come to you to get approval to do it.
Okay.
So they would make the request to you. You say, you know what, you need it. That's fine. Go ahead and install it. And they would make those payments.
So this right here is just about services and policies. Those
correct. Accommodations or services and policies, yes.
What if I didn't want my door torn out?
Yeah.
They would have
it's my
to.
My property.
That's fine, but they would still be required to restore it when they leave. And they would have to pay for it. So if I erect a ramp and you don't want it, when I leave, I have to pay to take it down.
Can you ask them to escrow the money?
No.
You can't find them after they leave.
That's exactly right.
When they leave, they would have to take it down.
Yeah, let's take that example a little further. Now, that ramp requires a variance. And the county's requirements, standards for granting a variance is that it's not created by the applicant. And that, just that one for example. You know, it's created by the applicant. So the Board of Adjustments, by law, is required to turn that down.
Well, the accommodation does apply also to the board.
But the law, it contradicts the law.
Fair housing trumps.
It's the federal law. So the way we kind of look at it, you have your state, your local, you have your ordinances, you have your zoning board, you have the state, and then you have the federal government way up here. And it trumps all of that. Deed restrictions, whatever you have down at the local level, it trumps all of that. So the accommodation can go all the way to the board, that this person needs it to enjoy that premises. And they would have to make their accommodations also.
With respect to the animals, can you do monthly inspections, and if they've done an amount of damage that absorbs that security deposit, you can then fix what they have done damage to and require another security deposit?
Would you do those inspections if
on
the person
everybody.
Didn't have a disability?
Yes, on everybody.
Oh, yeah.
You can go into their home, as you do everybody, maybe it's every 6 months, and if that pit bull that provides them antidepressant therapy
mm-hmm.
has done $1,000 worth of damage,
mm-hmm.
you can use their security deposit to fix it and then require them to pay another $1,000 security deposit.
Yes, as
okay.
long as
you do
everybody gets inspections.
Better have that in your lease.
Now, as long as if you just start doing inspections because this person comes on, they can say, you know what, this didn't happen prior to me moving into the complex or moving into this home. Now he wants to do 6 months for everybody because he knows I have a dog and he didn't do it prior.
Okay. We got to start sometime. Come on.
Start before the dog comes.
To bounce off what John was talking about with the variances and having the reasonable accommodation, if one of them was, say, adding a rampway for a wheelchair that maybe encroaches into the front yard setback, is there anything that requires or that would prohibit in the Fair Housing Act from saying at the end of, say, that person who is disabled no longer lives there or the disability is no longer in existence, that could then be removed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So we could...
You have to show the connection. There has to be a connection with the disability in order to even have it. So, for instance, if another person moves in there and that is remaining and now it's, you know, that person doesn't need it, it can be removed. Or it can be required to be moved. It should be required to be removed when that resident is about to move out. So that's something that you can do as the owner, saying, you know, once you move, this needs to be removed, and making sure that it's removed.
So the county could in fact require that there be a every couple years you show us that there's still the person who needs this, you know, that that needs this ramp is still living there.
You could be provided the information saying that this person still is there and still needs the ramp.
Kind of along the same lines with a ramp, and I hope I'm not going to regret asking this question, but he talked about a front yard setback, a side yard setback. Side yard setbacks are in place for building separation. So somebody comes in for a variance application to put a ramp in that is right up to their property line. Next door neighbor comes in and opposes it and says, this adversely affects my property values, you know, on down the line. And they have, you know, expert testimony and witnesses that say, you know, this is how my property value is now deteriorating because I'm going to have a ramp. I think what I'm hearing you say is that doesn't matter.
That doesn't matter.
What about?
Because now if it goes on to, for instance, if let's say they build it and it now goes on to that person's property, you know, they would have to make changes to that ramp so that it doesn't go on to there. But if it depreciates their home value or makes their insurance go up because someone's seen the ramp,
so they can infringe on setbacks, but it can't infringe on the property.
Right, correct. Mm-hmm. Correct.
And what about if it further impinges on the safety and welfare as fire officials, fire equipment and whatnot cannot have access between the two buildings?
Well, you would, you have to engage in a conversation about that. And what other things, maybe can they go to the other side? Can it be out the back and maybe come to the side? I'm saying there are some other conversations that can go along with that to make sure that person can exit the unit. So pretty much they need a ramp. Now, how that ramp goes about, that's at that point you would be considering what alternatives there could be. Because the one thing that remains is that person needs to exit the unit via ramp.
So to follow on that, if the Board of Adjustments say were to deny a ramp and a side yard setback, they couldn't say we're going to deny it. They'd have to say that it's not the best location.
Correct. Or we would need to table that and discuss some alternatives. I'm saying I don't know how you go about that in that setting, but that's what you would do.
Well, if I can kind of throw out something as kind of a general rule of thumb, if you will, so we can kind of, because we have quite a bit more training to do, and not to detract from the conversation. These are all very good questions. But what we want to do is kind of give you, again, the big general overview. These questions are very good, but I don't want to discount them. If we could, as if everybody is okay with it, if you have specific questions such as those, if you could document them down, maybe somehow work through your counsel or maybe through Karen, and we can get you the answer, good answers on those. The other thing I would encourage you to do, if you do have rentals or your manager or something like that, before writing down your policies, your procedures, I would consult with a real estate attorney, somebody who is knowledgeable in fair housing law. Or if you don't want to go that route, if you can ask us up front, hey, I'm thinking about doing this, is this okay? Well, sir, we're there to help. You know?
But you're not lawyers, right?
We're not lawyers, but we can cover the, I mean, we can easily give you the law just as well as anybody, the state law, Chapter 40, this Title 6.
In all honesty, just to kind of make a comment, a lot of times attorneys don't even know. I'm saying I've gotten attorneys who contacted me and say, do I really have, they've done all they need to do. Does this person really need to have this companion animal? An attorney. So because we enforce the law, we're constantly reading it. So even an attorney may advise you differently. I'm just saying, just as my experience in dealing with some attorneys in some cases. So.
Well, I've also called the IRS and had some of their people tell me stuff, and they're clueless.
You're right.
So I'm
curious.
I'm just
concerned that
if we have lawyers advising us and they're looking at the law, it'd be better them to get another attorney from...
Correct, our attorney general.
As opposed to investigators or whatever.
Correct.
Because again, you're covered so much. I mean,
correct.
There's
okay,
nothing
and,
you can't do.
And our AG, Barbara Gadboy, is more than willing to... Right. There's questions that attorneys have. Feel free to contact us, and we can set that up.
And we also, once again, in the contact in the folder we have our email addresses, phone numbers and stuff, 800 number. Give us a call, please. You know, absolutely, and we'll answer your question as best we can. Absolutely.
All right, so now we're going to go in the overview of affirmatively furthering fair housing. Under the Fair Housing Act, all federal housing and community development dollars carry the obligation to affirmatively further fair housing, and that's actually from the Act. All right,
request.
Purpose of affirmatively furthering fair housing obligation. One, to address housing discrimination, provide remedies for discrimination, prevent future discrimination, and to remove segregation and the effects of past discrimination. One of the things that Vince already pointed out is the recommendations from the NASA's impediment study. That is actually the first step in your obligation, and so it's already done for you. So now we just have to implement a plan to remove segregation throughout the state. Here's the certification, and when they talk about, I'm a little fast with this clicker. Regarding certification, talks about the when you receive federal dollars, it's a guarantee, which is required to submit a certification that it will affirmatively further fair housing, which means there's an analysis conducted, which is already done. Now we have to take appropriate actions to overcome the effects of the impediments and maintain records reflecting that the action has been taken. And as Vince mentioned, one of the action is training. So, and this is what we're doing now throughout the state. I tell y'all, get fast with this clicker. Each program and all actions within are covered, including, as you can see, public housing, multi-housing, multi-family housing, and all CDBG covered state entities, entitlement jurisdiction. Sorry. All right, now the obligations that apply to all funds. Although a grantee is obligated, obligation arises in connection with the receipt of federal funds. It's affirmative furthering fair housing obligation is not to restrict to the design or the operation of HUD-funded programs. So pretty much it does not just apply to HUD-funded programs. It applies to those who don't receive federal monies, whether publicly or privately. This clicker is not working with me fast today. Okay, recipient municipalities and jurisdiction must. The analysis is already, a series of analysis of barriers, which is already completed. Establish steps to overcome these barriers, and then, of course, establish a plan and timeline to enact the identified steps. So here are a couple of the key issues and barriers to housing, which do not just lack affordable housing. It's actually where it's located, how it's marked, how those areas are identified. Whether zoning or funding decisions limits opportunities of a person with a protected class, and that's one thing you must consider in decision making. How could this possibly impact a person of a protected class? Does this impact minorities? Does this impact families? Does this impact person of a religious belief or persons with disabilities? Some more key issues. Sometimes in making the decision, there are unsupported stereotypes. In making the decision, you have to make sure you support it with something that does not steer towards a protected class. So for instance, if it's, I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but when it's unsupported stereotypes, prejudices that possibly stem from fear, as part of making the decision, then that's when the affirmatively furthering fair housing comes into play. So, as an investigator, these are some of the things that we look at, some of the elements that are looked at when looking at decisions that have a discriminatory objective. One, the discriminatory impact of the action. Some background. Give me some information about what happened in the past, how the area has changed, so that we know why this decision was made. And then, of course, the sequence of events leading up to the action. Some of the things that the person did in trying to bring this to possibly even be voted on. And then, of course, you know, were there departures of normal procedures? Did you go out of your normal the normal course of action that you would normally take to find additional information that would possibly affect a person of a protected class? And if you departure from your normal application criteria, so pretty much not deviating from your normal the normal way you do things. So,
can you go back one second?
Sure.
What is the funding source? Let's do a hypothetical. The state of Delaware provides funds to an affordable housing group.
Okay.
And then they go and they select a site to build affordable housing on.
Okay.
And then the funding source, the state of Delaware, decides that they think that location is inappropriate.
Okay.
Is that a reason for not allowing?
How do they support that?
Because the state of Delaware says, hypothetical, that they're spending money for this type of housing where they have public infrastructure, transportation, and that sort of thing available, so they avoid forcing people to buy cars. So they're saying, we love the project. They're not opposed to the project whatsoever, but they want it more in proximity to those public services.
So tell me why would they want it? They just wanted there to basically bring money into the state?
No, it has nothing to do with income to the state. It has to do with combining the fair housing opportunity with the rest of the public investment to provide public transportation. In other words, they're trying to help these people out.
Right.
They just tell you out.
Keep them close to transportation.
Sure. They want closer to the towns, whatever, schools, things. Because these people are poor, because they can't really go to travel back and forth to get this.
That can be perceived as a possible bias. If they want to build the property here, and I'm saying if they can afford the property and the land is okay, I'm saying if you can look at everything, and the only thing that the state can say is that you can't build it there because it's not close to bus transportation and or some other education. Some schools.
So even though it's the state's money and the state objects using their money in that way, it would still be biased
if it supports a person of a protected class. You got to think of disparate impact. Who does this impact when this housing is not built?
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
So a lot of times in making decisions, you got to think about who does this impact? Does this impact persons? Minorities? Does this impact persons with disabilities in making this decision? How does this impact that group of people? And then that's where statistics and all that come into play, where they say, well, wait a minute, this is, the proximity, this is how many people are in this area, this is what we want to put in there. The reason they don't want to put it in there is because now it may not be, they would have to argue those cases as they go, through HUD and the complaints filed.
Well, at this point, they can't classify them as minorities or any other group because they're just trying to get this thing started.
Who would benefit?
Well, it would benefit those that got the money from the state to try to get them in a good location,
and
regardless who they are. Regardless, we're not into a minority situation here yet. So you're going further, but you're looking beyond thinking, well, it's minorities. In fact, the minorities today, according to the news the other day, white children are minorities today because there's less white than there's any other people raised born in the United States today. So when you talk about minorities, I don't know if we really can go that way anymore. I think we just need to be fair here and say, is this fair to these people, whoever they are?
Mm-hmm.
Moving these people way out in the country, then we have to furnish public transportation, we have to give more money for more public services, and probably end up pushing a school. Is that really being fair to anybody? To the taxpayer and everybody else. Look this whole picture over.
Mm-hmm.
You will disagree.
I understand. I can't disagree. It's. I'm saying, if they service a certain protected class and they're building it to help the protected mm-hmm. class, it's an argument they can make. And if you're going to defend it for whatever reason, you can defend your decision. Anybody else?
Yeah, I'll say more.
All right. Anybody else have a question on elements, on those elements? All right, here's a case number three. Since 2006, Jefferson Parish, Louisiana, which is a predominantly Caucasian area, and this is actually prior to Katrina, has taken aggressive steps. And actually, this actually happened right after Katrina. This is a true story. Took aggressive steps to reduce zoning density. And one parish council member said these choices were made because you would be having folks from Orleans, New Orleans Parish, who lived in public housing complex in Jefferson Parish, and that's just not something I'm interested in. Those are quotes. That's his statement that he made. And of course, HUD took this case on and filed a complaint against him and move forward with that case. I don't know the results of this case, but this is actually a true story that happened in Louisiana right after Katrina.
Well, HUD hasn't decided. I'm just wondering, based on what you said, what do you think the outcome of that is?
I would question why he took steps to reduce zoning density, which would allow a certain amount of people to live in Jefferson Parish. I would wonder why he did that. And the fact that he made the comment, having folks from Orleans, what type of folk live in Orleans?
So the zoning density reduction just in itself, that's probably content neutral. I mean, you could
that's
do that.
A content neutral,
yeah,
yes.
That's the right, and that's what I'm
but then you then you're looking at the events that are taking place. So Katrina happens, everybody in Orleans has to vacate.
You're not interested in Jason.
Now you're not interested in a certain amount of people living, you're making the argument, you're showing the impact. And why you would now, prior to Katrina, it wasn't on your table for discussion. So that's how when the history of events start coming into play, the argument can be made.
Was it because of high crime rates, maybe?
What kind of folks commit crimes?
I don't know. I'm just saying, was that area high crime? You know, certain areas have high crime rates, regardless of the area. Is that the reason?
I'm saying the argument can be made. I'm saying all arguments can be made and defended.
Would that be a good argument? High crime?
High crime.
Would you want to bring criminals into your area and live?
Was the whole area crime infested? I'm saying you would have to, that would be difficult to defend. Especially when he says the folks.
Is there a balancing test that they use with things like, we'd like to reduce zoning density because getting public service there, whether it's we're concerned about the size of roads, having fire and safety, that kind of thing. Is that something that is considered in a case like that when a fair housing complaint is raised?
So let's say prior to Katrina, he raised this without Katrina coming. And he said, we have to reduce zoning density because we've noticed that more people are moving to Jefferson Parish, and it's going to be difficult for us to widen roads, to add additional sewers. We're just noticing it's not against a protected class. It's just we're noticing for this town that is happening. Then there you go. You're working on that. But as long as now, in this case, Katrina happened and people are moving, so he goes and quickly starts, reducing the zoning density. So someone can look at that and say, well, why are you now? And then what makes it so bad is the comments he made.
Right.
Yeah. That further supports.
Clearly
further supports.
But there is some level of balancing test.
Correct. And that's why when you look at the elements, we look at the history, we look at some other things to determine whether or not you're doing this because something's going on. I'm saying, what's happening in your town that you are requiring some zoning density to be done?
Well, chances are it's a flood zone, and that could be a good reason.
If there's other problems, and it's
safety
not...
Safety and welfare of the people would be less people, would be less danger.
Sure.
Yep.
Less people. All right.
Yep. So because it happened after Katrina and people were fleeing too quickly. So if it's neutral on its face and you're not doing it for any other reason, any other bias or stereotype, then you're fine.
So your point is just be careful with your
choice
of words.
Be careful. Be very careful with your choice. Those types,
sand.
You can open your mouth, just go in a circle.
What do you say?
How about if you hold a public hearing and these are coming from the public and it's not the council's opinion or anything? How does that factor in?
As long as your decision is not reflected upon what those people are saying, then you'll be okay.
Well, you have no control.
You don't have control of freedom of speech. If they want to make their comments and say why, and I don't want them in here because I just don't, that's why I moved to Jefferson Parish. Those are those comments. Now, if your decision is reflected on what the neighborhood and other people are telling you, then you are also liable.
Are Democrats a protected class?
What county?
No.
Good.
Any other questions about this case example?
So political affiliation
can
be protected.
Yeah, see, okay,
it's
not protected.
Yeah, but with
Vance, it's a creed. So George can have an apartment complex, right, that excludes Democrats.
With Sam's, it's a creed. Marty, you said.
Well, so now,
I don't know how to spell.
So the question is, if it excludes Democrats, well, what protected classes are normally Democrats? This is a disparate impact case. You know, always think of, in any decision, disparate impact.
Democrats are the ones that are disabled.
Well, they redistrict people. They redistrict and put certain people in certain districts. Certain people.
Y'all get to a political aspect.
Moving right along.
moving along. Case number four. A town amends its zoning ordinance to bar an assisted living facility in a particular zone following expressions of community hostility.
I don't like it. It's not in the ordinance. We can't do it.
But if the community hostility was only a portion of that public hearing and you had other reasons, you know, you could still turn it down.
Who does this service? Who does this service?
Oh, the assisted living?
Who does the assisted living facility service? This goes into your reasonable accommodations. Service is the persons with disabilities.
But you'd have to have that in the record, though. There would have to be...
They would have to support who it's servicing and that the persons are protected.
So then under that scenario, if somebody wanted to put an assisted living facility somewhere that's in our agricultural residential zone, I don't know what the code says, but say that's not a permitted use there. What I think you're going to say is it doesn't matter.
They make the argument that it services persons with disabilities, and
so the surrounding neighborhood that relied on the zoning to, you know, make their homestead, you know, they have then no rights in that situation, because this is sort of the scenario we're dealing with. The folks that you're talking to, it's, you know, we've been talking about rental units and things like that, but with the Planning and Zoning Commission, the County Council, the Board of Adjustment, it's all zoning, and these are the kinds of things that we deal with daily, multiple times a year in big public hearings with lots of opposition. So in that case, you've got some developer who's got plans to put an assisted living facility, plunk it down in the middle of a rural area.
And
there's 150 people that are property owners that don't want it. Are you telling me that the county can't deny it?
Who would that impact without that living facility?
All those property owners.
But Vince, keep in mind, as I referred, she's just an investigator.
No, I know.
We don't want to make our opinions on what we do in the future based on her opinion or his opinion. Neither one of you are.
I'm just asking what her
attorneys, and I'm just a little.
Well, what would happen is, at that point...
Follow this line of thinking.
Oh, I agree.
I'm saying that's fine. I'm saying if you deny it and...
Better have good reasons.
Have a good, very good reason. Sure. Because if someone files a fair housing complaint and HUD takes it over and you have to provide some defenses, be prepared.
Well, I think the fair housing issue has to be on the record, okay? And even if it's on the record, I believe there are provisions that say if other facilities are available... You don't necessarily have to approve something in this location if it's available next door or if it's available down the street.
Or at least I would suggest to you that that's a reasonable argument that could be made.
It could be an argument, or whether or not that facility is, the reason why they're building this facility is because that facility is now full, there's no services for persons who need
they
the services
justify,
in that area.
Sure.
I'm saying you can,
but if there's
argument can always be made.
What we say is if there's properly zoned land for that use, and they go into a zone that's not, you know, that's not a permitted use, many times they go there because it's cheaper land and other reasons why they went there and chose that land. We can deny that. If there's, you know, we have zones that permit this type of use. It's not like we've excluded that use. You can put those places.
That's right. Yeah.
So
we can, Vince. We don't, yeah.
I'm not taking that position.
No,
I'm not taking the position.
At that point, you engage in the interactive process and talk about that. Do they know? Do they know that it's just a different thing called?
Did you say
between the two zoning areas? You had a question in your back?
I was just kind of piggyback on that. So if in the event an application is just, it may be a poor application in general, but coincidentally, there's significant community opposition that's put on record. And if council would have normally, you know, not passed it, but now because there's this community opposition, it's automatically going to be considered a fair housing complaint. I mean, that's
no, as long as their reason, whatever opposition they have, as long as there's a reason behind their opposition, and it's not steered solely from the community or others who are requesting that it not be built.
So,
yeah, persons being rehabilitated for criminal felony activity, are they a protected class?
If a person, HUD says, not me, that if a person had an addiction to drugs and has gone through rehab, that person who's rehabilitated is now considered a person with a mental disability. So that's how they are covered. But if they are currently using, they are not covered in any way.
We had to know that.
What about, and I guess what
you can't
I'm thinking, the concern, because it has we've had incidents or more or maybe more than one where someone wanted to put a group home to help rehabilitate felons of all types of rapists or thieves or what have you.
Well, sexual disorders are not covered.
Okay. So it's just somebody out of prison. Sometimes they let guys out early. Their prison term is not over, but they let them out a little early and try to get them in a community, and we put them in a group home in your neighborhood. Are they protected? That's basically what
I'm
saying. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes.
Guy who robbed a bank.
You're saying felons are protected?
No, I'm saying someone who was using drugs and is rehabilitated and went through rehabilitation is covered. Not, you know, a person who robbed the home. Now this is the opposite side. Can someone make the argument that it's a disparate impact on a protected class? There's your argument that someone can bring up.
Basically, be challenged on anything, so whether just go on as normal.
The issue is to protect the class. There,
right?
You have to first demonstrate that they're a protected
person
class.
Correct. You do have a prima facie element that you have to go through.
Right.
You know, are you a person with a protected class? You know, that's the first one.
Right.
And how do you fall in that category? Is that are you? Is a transition? Is the home for all men? You know, they make an argument that the protected class is males or females. Okay. Our complaint process, we're almost finished. A complaint can be filed by any person, aggrieved persons, or group of people that have been a victim of fair housing, of discrimination in Delaware. The violation has to occur within 1 year of the discriminatory act or when they obtain knowledge of the discriminatory practice. Now, it has to be filed in writing. It can be on a letter, can be on something in writing to the division in order to fall within the 1 year. There are some times where a complainant is on, you know, it has to be within 1 year. So on day 365, They come to our office. They felt they're in the one-year time period. They called our office day 365. Now, if they fall outside of the statute of limitations, which is the 1 year, they can go, they can proceed to a federal court within 2 years of the violation.
Now, who pays for all this? These people that go to see these, see you, who pays for all this? Lawyers and everything? Do they get a free ride on this?
Who file a complaint with our office?
Yes.
They can represent themselves. They can obtain an attorney through our process if they choose. If they represent themselves throughout our entire process, if we deem that it's a cause finding that the discrimination actually occurred, our AG takes that case forward. We, the division, file a charge and move that case forward to court.
So the state pays for their attorney.
The federal government.
Or whoever. State paid. They got their lawyer furnished.
The federal government.
Now, the one they're suing does not have no attorney. If he does get one, he pays for himself.
Now.
And if they happen to be wrong, during the meanwhile, they're screwing with him for a year or two, and then he's turned around and lost the case. Actually, he wins, but he loses because of the lawyer's fees.
There is a recourse in the statutes that says if the respondent believes that this case was brought against them frivolously, they can ask for attorney's fees, that their attorney fees be paid. There is that portion in the statute that does exist.
And if they don't have no money, what do you do?
Well, they don't need an attorney through our process.
Well, he's got a free attorney, remember. He don't have to have the money. The other guy does.
He doesn't have to have it through our process.
Well, No.
If we file a complaint and you decide not to hire an attorney, bring your defend your case.
Yeah, well, who wants to defend their case against you guys that's got all this upstairs knowledge, you know?
Well, through the process, it's just the choices of both the complainant and the respondent. You can choose to get an attorney through the process, through the investigation. Once it leaves that, we have an attorney. So if you choose to get one or not, that's up to you.
Yeah, but you're paying for yours for that person's benefit. The defendant has to pay for his own. What the gentleman is suggesting is that there's an inequity there. Perhaps you should pay for both attorneys.
That's fair.
You know, that would be reasonable.
That's fair. We're talking about fair here today. Why would it be fair?
Well, it's my tax dollar.
Then both sides.
That's right.
Well, At the point, there's a charge. The enforcement steps in. So now we're enforcing what we believe to be discrimination.
Let me try to clarify just for a moment, if I can.
I've been proven guilty for a meeting.
Yeah.
Before I'm still innocent.
Okay. The key element in that is an aggrieved person. First of all, has to go through an investigation to find a cause, find cause evidence to believe that, yes, discrimination occurred, okay, number one. And then at that point, if either party says, you know what, I want to go to court and I want a trial, a court by, with a trial, then that's the way it goes, okay? By statute, by law, the attorney representation is covered, okay? Where does that pot of money come from? Does it come from the taxpayers? No. We have what's called a special administrative fund. That's one of our core budget items.
Where's that come from?
That money comes from, good question, it comes from settlements from previous cases. Okay? And if there is an adjudication, and this is something you have to be very cognizant of. Has anybody ever been sued? Okay? All right. The amount of money, and I'm not trying to be overly dramatic here, but the amount of money involved can get very staggering, can get into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, and I'm not exaggerating. Okay. If a judgment is for that complainant, they say, we want to pay for our attorney fees, and the judge says yes, and it's, unless it goes through appeals, then it might be $50,000 for attorney fees. And that money is going to go back into that special administrative fund. That's where that money is coming from. The reason why, again, the whole reason why the preventative measures, so we didn't have to go that route. Nobody wants to go to court, honestly. It costs a lot of time, a lot of money. People, most complainants, they can't afford to defend themselves. They're just like, anybody in this room. They don't have the money to defend themselves. And many times the respondents don't either. Okay? So there is conciliation involved in it. I don't want to go too much into that, but I wanted to clarify where that money was coming from. And the answer, the simple answer for it, is because it's required by law.
So this is our investigative process. Once a complaint is filed with our office, we have 100 days to complete our investigation unless it's deemed complex, which HUD allows us additional time. If it's a complex case, sometimes our mortgage cases are deemed complex. In every case, we have a fact-finding conference where we bring both parties together to discuss what took place and leading up to the filing of the complaint. A lot of times, we are able to resolve our complaints at that conference. It's a misunderstanding. Someone didn't know what was being either requested or it wasn't clear. They'd be able to talk to each other. We actually mediate that situation, and we're able to resolve those complaints. Now, if we're unable to resolve the complaint, we continue the investigation, and we find either cause or no cause. If there's a cause finding, there's an election process where they can elect for the case to go in front of our panel of commissioners or to court. If there's a no cause finding, meaning we can't find reason to believe that discrimination is occurring in this case, we write a no cause and the case is dismissed. Now, throughout the entire process, conciliation is available. So if we leave the table and people feel that later on they have another alternative, then they can bring it up and we can possibly do it through that process. So, but it's available throughout the entire 100 days. These are some of the reliefs that are obtained for the complainant in some cases. They've obtained housing, accommodation is granted, there's injunctive relief, monetary damages, punitive damages, and sometimes awarded attorney's fees and costs.
If you do away with the last four of those, you would cut out most of the issue. If these things could be adjudicated and your only available remedies are specific performance and not money, you would see a lot less of this go to court, and you guys would be able to solve a lot more of this at your level. That's what I think the problem that folks have with this.
Absolutely.
Is the process gets to be ridiculously expensive for everybody. Plus, you're awarding money damages for something that is so, you know, esoteric. I mean, I'm sorry that somebody's feelings are hurt, but I don't think we can pay for that.
Well, a lot of times, and then we even tell complainants when they file a complaint with our office, why do you believe you're entitled to $50,000?
Yeah.
Show me where you had to move 100 miles away from your job and the house that you were intentionally going to buy was located 4 miles. You know, show me that you had to, a diversion of services or show me something. You can't just go in and say, my feelings were hurt and I think it cost me $50,000 because I'm hurt.
I need a vacation.
I need a vacation. Correct. No, they have to support it. And we actually give them a damages worksheet to start looking at what are your damages? Where did you lose something here? So it's not just, oh, I didn't get the house and you owe me $50,000. You know, they have to make the argument. So it's not just on the face, you know, you want $50,000 and we're going to walk away. But a lot of times, the first two happen. Because if someone is truly hurt by a reasonable accommodation that's not granted, they just really want to be able to park close to their home. And a lot of times, a letter of apology, some training goes into place, and they get the spot. That's a lot of cases. A lot of them. Because the person just really wants to enjoy the home. Or need a railing in the bathroom because they fell 3 times, and now they're a danger to themselves. Or they can't get the wheelchair in there. Or it takes them a long time because the carpet is this thick. And they want the carpet swapped out. So the landlord says, you know what, I don't mind paying for it. Or a lot of times, in that case, the person will pay for it. It's a modification. It's a structural change. They'll go and say, you know what, change it as long as you put it back. And that's in place for the landlord so that they don't have to go and put carpet for someone who doesn't want this very thin carpet. So that's why that's in place.
Currently, how many investigations do you have going on in the state at one point, any given year or whatever? Do you have any idea, like right now?
File complaints?
Yeah. Whatever, official complaints. How many official complaints do you have right now?
Official file complaints, about...
Right now, we have 20. On the books about 15.
In the whole 14. State?
That are being investigated. But then we also have intakes that go into, that need to be drafted and get into that process. So
even though it sounds so scary, there's not a whole lot of... I mean, 15 doesn't seem like a whole lot for a whole state of Delaware.
Well, that's, you know, in any given year, that's what our minimum is required by HUD, but actually we've up to like 22, 23 fair housing complaints.
Yearly.
A yearly.
Okay.
Yeah.
HUD requires a minimum?
Yes. for every state, depending on how many people, the population. So like PA, would be required, would have a minimum of certain amount of cases. I know Delaware State is 15. Based on our population.
So you're saying that there is a required minimum amount of investigations, whether or not there's the issues or not?
Well, for instance, if HUD's going to keep us, let's say, for instance, there's an area where they're not getting complaints, why would HUD need to keep that enforcement agency there?
Isn't that an incentive to have an investigation?
We don't fish them out.
In other words, you're being justified. Your wages are being justified through HUD, and our tax dollars are being wasted to keep you in your job. But exactly what it falls down to.
That's an opinion.
What's the intake number in a given year?
Intakes?
Yeah.
A lot greater.
So there's a large number, and then you, through the review process, whittle that down and determine which ones.
Right, determine whether it's landlord tenant. It's not
like
really
a couple hundred or more than that.
I would say 50, 60 a year that come in that we determine.
That there's basis or no basis.
Right. And it's not non-jurisdiction for whatever. Sometimes the complainant doesn't even want to go forward with the process.
You should have no trouble meeting that minimum with Sussex County. We got a lot of pitfalls around here.
Here are some of the penalties. Here are some of the civil penalties. If a complaint is filed, the first, there's hasn't been any other complaint filed, and we get to a cause finding, the first, and we talked in the beginning about prohibited acts. Each of them is considered a practice. So, for instance, if you refuse to rent and you intimidated the person, that's a $20,000 civil penalty. Now, if in 5 years the person still hasn't learned their lesson, the civil penalty increases to $25,000. And then in 7 years, if they commit more than two, the penalty goes up to $50,000 for each discriminatory practice. And I'm finished.
I bet you're glad.
And these are our locations. Thank you so much for participating in this process.
One thing before we close out, if everybody would please, for our own benefit,
do our evaluation.
And I kind of call your attention to, you can put anything you want on here, but if there's an issue you have as far as the wall, we can't do anything about the wall. Okay, you know. But as far as the content, if there's something we can do better to improve or something, please let us know. Or something, you know, if we did something right, let us know.
And if you feel that we need to maybe in the future come back and talk specifically about some zoning issues, we would love to bring HUD with us, our forces behind us, so that, you know, they can answer some more detailed questions if you choose. So, but we're always here.
It would be good entertainment to bring.
Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
We'll entertain a motion to recess to 1 o'clock.
So moved.
Second.
Any questions on the motion? Cole.
Yes.
David.
Yes.
Cole.
Yes.
Wolf. Yes. We have two. We're recessed to 1 o'clock. I think food is back in the back.
Please help yourself.